Okay, I have time. So I call this meeting of the Audit, Compliance, and Title IX Committee to order. Could we have roll call?
Chair Carter?
Here.
Vice Chair Perkins?
Here.
Here. Regent Getty?
Here.
Regent Hayes?
Here.
Regent McMichael?
Here.
You do have a quorum.
Fantastic. We'll move on to item one, public comment. Do we have any public comment?
There is no public comment.
On to number two, consent items. Mr. Sunberry, did you have anything you wanted to address in the consent item?
Nothing specific, Chair Carter.
Okay. So I'd entertain a motion to accept our, or I'm sorry, to approve our consent items.
So moved.
Second.
So moved by Perkins. That Geddes is a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Item passes. We'll move on to item number three, travel TMCC. Chief Internal Auditor Josenberry.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Bill Sunberry, Chief Internal Auditor. In the audit summary document, I've included, as I normally do, the table of reports being presented today, along with any key observations. And before I get started, again, just wanted to say thank you to the institutions with reports and updates being presented today. Much like the last meeting, we're working remotely. We're working around kind of our normal processes with the institutions to have a lot of these conversations remotely and finish our audit tests. So that couldn't happen without some great cooperation and collaboration on their part. So thank you. This first audit report for discussion today is an audit of travel at TMCC. Overall, internal audit's opinion is that the travel function is operating in a satisfactory manner. We did bring forward what are hopefully useful recommendations for improvement. This includes development of international travel policy and athletic team procedures as it relates to travel, as well as some opportunity to enhance controls surrounding documentation processes and P-card usage. We did note approximately $3,000 in international travel that was paid for in international student fees. And so we suggested that this may require some additional review and potentially an update to NC-wide policy for some clarification. So, you know, just taking a step back, whenever we do an audit like this one, if we come across a situation like this, although the audit is performed at a specific institution, in this case TMCC, we think it makes sense to leverage what we've observed and, you know, take that conversation system-wide. And just a quick side note on that front, in addition to the responses provided by TMCC that are embedded in the audit report and the reference materials today, I do want to note for the record that the Business Officers Council had this item on their agenda yesterday and are taking this back to the appropriate stakeholders with some ideas. So I anticipate by the time we bring this back for its standard follow-up, there'll be some collective updates on that front. Thanks.
No, this was a good audit. There was a couple of things, like you said, that we found that were policy changes needed. I think TMCC is addressing those, so I think we're pretty good to go there. President Hilgerson, did you want to say anything more towards any of those things that we found?
Yes, I'm President Hilgerson for the record, and I'd be happy to add that when the Planning Council returned, and we have about over 30 people on the Planning Council at TMCC, many of them are faculty who were off contract until recently. And at their first meeting, we presented both the travel policy for athletics and the travel policy of upgrade for international travel. The Planning Council approved of those policies this week. So, and we're very thankful to the auditors for pointing out where we could be stronger. And I think it is a good audit. And I think we learned some good things from it. So thank you so much. And I'm also very thankful to Jim New and his team. They did a really great job formulating the policy for the Planning Council review. And whenever we work on these items, we are looking to the universities. We're looking to other institutions who already do these procedures and policies. And it's nice now that we have documents that reflect current practice.
Thank you. Do we have a motion to accept?
Motion by Geddes.
Second.
Yeah. Motion from Geddes, second from Regent Hayes. Do we have any discussion or questions? Seeing none. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Hearing none, this motion passes. We'll move on to item number 4, follow-up dental faculty practice in Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. A majority of the committee that was here for the June meeting is intact today, but as a friendly refresher, the CSN dental faculty practice audit report was presented at the June Audit Compliance and Title IX committee meeting. And at that meeting, it was requested that we bring this back for an update, a detailed update at the next meeting. So this is in line with the facilitated discussion approach that we've tried to enable for this particular audit. And we have invited Dr. Sonia Pearson to speak to the status of CSN's noted action plans. So I can't see on my screen if she's out there, Chair Carter, but I'll turn it back to you if you'd be willing to bring forward virtually Dr. Pearson. Thank you.
Nope, I see Ms. Pearson now. You have the floor.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Sonia Pearson, Campus Provost, College for the Southern College of Southern Nevada. I first want to thank you all for allowing CSN to come back and report on what I believe is really good progress over the last 30 to 60 to 90 days. If you recall, when we convened in June, there was a commitment that we would actually move the needle forward in a positive direction over the next 30 to 60, 90 days. So what I want to do today is take some good time to speak to the August 4th report that you actually received, but specifically looking at the areas that were in progress by the time you received that August 4th report. June 26th, which was 15 days into our 30-day plan, we reported a progress report to the NC auditors that showed a good amount of traction on many of the audit findings. In fact, it was 80% complete by June 26th. Some of the main items that we completed at that time were included 5 policies and procedure manuals, which was also inclusive of a COVID-19. And quality assurance training manual. Now, while we do not have those items loaded into our electronic Canvas database, so we can have more automated tracking of employee training, we are still conducting the face-to-face trainings, if you will, or via Teams. I think that in itself, within that 15-day window, shows that the DFP has the ability to align itself with some best practice institutions. Moving into our 30 to 60 day window, this began to look more at that August 4th report, item 2. Item 2 was more about accounts receivables. And with our accounts receivable, there were 9 areas that we still needed to focus on to implement or execute. By the 30 to 60 day window, we had successfully completed 5 of those items, which included looking at a staffing agency. That was where we had some real ongoing transitions that impacted our ability to maintain good productions, collections, keep track of our aging reports. So we have 2 plausible staffing agencies that we can call upon for key positions within the DFP. The other area that was important was making sure that the core staffing positions had the appropriate job descriptions that aligned with the policies and procedure manuals as well as compliance. We today have that completed. The other area was to make sure that we had a billing agency that aligned itself with some of the high priorities and gaps that we noted in the audit report. We are pleased to report that we do have a billing agency that we are going to continue to work with, TSI. This is also a billing agency utilized by UNLV. The last area that was really focused on in the 30 to 60 day was, again, the collection efforts. We wanted to move our collections from 90 days plus to 30 to 60 days. I'm glad to report that we are within that window and quickly moving to be less than 30 days in our monitoring of our collections. For the months of July and August, we also reported that our collections exceeded our expenses. So once again, those are positive areas of movement in the right direction. Over the 60 to 90 day period, which looks more at a final item in section two, which was the write-offs, we had a number of accounts dating back many years that were still showing on the books. There were 2,300 patient accounts that were evaluated. We submitted a write-off request to our vice president of finances that was well over $400,000. Again, good to say that we have addressed some lack of self-pay issues, untimely reporting, some uncredential provider insurance claims, and working with some collection agencies that were sitting on some accounts that hadn't had any activity in several years. So those are the areas that were remaining in item two. Moving forward to item four, where we had some additional incomplete items, we wanted to look at partnerships. And Regent Hayes mentioned before that when we think about the DFP, it's important that we look at how are we aligning with best practice models. I mentioned in the last convening that I come by way of Oklahoma and Arizona. So I'm familiar with these type of models and quickly began to research with the DFP leadership and the CSN leadership some options that we had yet to explore. When we're looking at partnerships, there's three important pillars that we're trying to address to also satisfy the audit and stabilize our finances. One is, how do we look at first our core mission, teaching and learning? We need to be sure to look at other clinical opportunities outside of just the DFP. That's important for our students to create some diversity in their learning as well, and it also helps us to keep administrative costs low. The other part of the partnership is, how do we stabilize our patient pipeline? So I mentioned earlier our outreach to Clark County Social Services, Accessible Space Incorporated, and the Department of Health and Human Services. Those are some of the immediate entities that we're working with to build that patient pipeline. The last area of partnership looks at, how do we partner with entities that will help to bring in resources that will also help us to leverage, if not lower, our administrative costs? We pursued grants. Unfortunately, with COVID-19, the one grant we pursued at that time was discontinued, but it has not stopped our efforts to look strategically at partnerships that will help us to leverage resources that we do not have right now. But most importantly, we need to look at our system. And what is our system doing right now? Our system partners that we can borrow from, but more importantly, align our DFP with what they're doing and look at how we can start to mirror those activities and maybe even look at how they can help to assume some of the responsibilities that we've been taking on at CSN. So one of the partners, obviously, is the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. So we're going to be meeting with them probably in the next week or so. And in our next meeting, I'll be glad to report out on how that is actually evolving. The other partnership, as I mentioned, is who can we partner with outside of our system? And those are discussions that we are still moving forward with. The best practice institutions that are out there and making these type of clinics work have some odd of 50 partners that they're working with. Okay, I don't think that CSN is going to have 50 partners, but we need to have the right partners at the table. So in whole, I wanted to report back on the behalf of CSN and the college president that I believe that we're trending in the right direction. Our collections are good. Our last 2 months reflect that we're moving in the right direction. And more importantly, we have resolved the audit findings, with the exception of looking at the final financial stability plan, which will call for us to get additional partners in place. So with that, that concludes my update on the 30, 60, 90-day plan for the CSN DFP.
Thank you. I think that's a lot of great progress. So I think we'll start our discussion with Regent Hayes. Did you have something?
I didn't, but I can. No, I just appreciate that. We talked about this some in the Business Finance and Facilities Committee on the fiscal exceptions report, and you know, and I think Ms. Pearson's right. It's time to look at different models, and I appreciate that they're going out and doing it. Probably should have happened a couple of years ago, but I'm not going to look back. I'm going to look at what we're doing right now, and look forward to seeing what you bring back to us and how we can still serve the students, serve the community, but not lose money while doing it. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Oh, sure, please.
When looking at those partnerships, the cooperative extension is also might be an available partner. I don't know if I mentioned that earlier. They are looking for things that specifically to do in Southern Nevada, because the money that's collected in Southern Nevada has to stay in Southern Nevada. And so they might be able to give you a pipeline of either clients or some clinic sites or, you know, something along those lines. Just a suggestion. Thank you. And I'm proud of all the progress that you've made from the last meeting to this one. It's a difference between night and early afternoon.
Thank you very much, Regent Hayes. I'm sorry, Regent Perkins.
Any other discussion or questions? Mr. Sunberry.
Thanks, Chair Carter. And just a point of clarification. So at the next meeting, that would be our standard six-month follow-up, which would be much like you saw today in the consent agenda, where we'd ask CSN to prepare their findings, and we'd normally stick that in consent. But if I heard Dr. Pearson's comments correctly, it sounded like she might be willing to come back and speak to some of the details at the next meeting too. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but certainly just want to make sure that we clarify that for the whatever the committee's wishes are. We'll just make sure that we do that for the December meeting. Thanks.
So yes, sir, I think that is appropriate timing, and I think it's part of our due diligence to keep the regents and the audit committee aware of how we're progressing and continue to receive your guidance and execute on that to the best of our ability.
I'm very happy to see the forward progress. I think that's fantastic. Any other discussion or question? I see on the agenda it says it's an action item. Could I just ask for some clarity? I'm sorry, Mr. Schietti, on what the action would be? Would it just be to approve the report, or is this really just an information item?
Dr. Carter, this is Joe Summer. I will defer to Zalelem if he's on the line, but I had put this forward as an action item, knowing that CSN had prepared that document, and I didn't know if there were parts of that would you know, require some discussion, direction, whatnot. So I wanted at least the option to be there, but I'll defer to the lawyer in the virtual room. Thanks.
Zalalem Bogala, Chair Carter here on this question. If there's action to be taken, I guess you can take it, right? We've advised the public that this is for possible action. But if there's, you know, if there's no action to be taken, you don't have to do it just because it says it's for possible action.
Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Chair Carter. I was just going to move acceptance of the report, but it doesn't sound like we need that.
We can do that if we have a second.
Second.
There we go. Okay. Any other discussion?
I was just going to say I'm fine with just taking this as a as an information item rather than a motion, but I'm too late for that.
Any other discussion or questions? Okay. All in favor to accept the report, say aye.
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 Any opposed? So this motion passes. So we'll go on to item number 5, Internal Audit Department Work Plan and Status Report. Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. And I appreciate the committee's indulgence on this particular item. At the June meeting, I had referenced the idea of kind of moving the work plan and those discussions further away from the static sort of one-year plan that we've done historically and moving toward a semi-annual plan. So this is the first part of this document is my initial attempt at that. So as I stated in June, I think the approach of going to a semi-annual plan update is good for a few reasons. I'd like to give the audit committee as much of a real-time snapshot of what we're planning to work on, what we're working on currently, as well as the monitoring of items that we've already worked on. So this full document follows that same logic. I'll point the committee to pages 3 and 4, which speak to the approach of how the plan was put together, measures taken to ensure the plan builds in agility and flexibility. And page 3 and 4 also speak to some of the highlights and themes, if you will, of the audit plan. And while I won't read those verbatim, I did want to touch on a few bullet points. One is the training aspect. I always like to drive home that point with the committee, just to show the commitment from the audit team in terms of continuing our education, staying current with best practices. My theme since I got here a few years ago was relevance, right? I want our team to stay relevant. And so to do so, I think internal and external training has to be included and expected, right? So another ongoing theme is just the concept of, you know, process reviews versus transactional reviews. I think the feedback from the institutions by and large tends to be our reports and our group adds the most value when we can recommend process improvements. So to that end, we really try to take some of those traditional audits that may be a little heavier in transactional testing and redesign them to capture more process analysis. I think that goes hand in hand with quicker turnaround on some of our reports. So I've budgeted a little less time for some of these audits so that we can stay focused on higher risk areas and again, try to turn around a timely deliverable. And then the last point I just wanted to make is cost savings. I think obviously in today's environment, this is very important and it's something that's always been important to my team. I think every auditor takes pride in that concept of being a part of cost avoidance. Ensuring, hey, if we're compliant and we're avoiding fines and penalties, that's good. And there's certainly value that is there for sure. But we're working on more projects that have a direct cost savings to them, notably external audit assistance, and then taking on some projects in-house that otherwise would have required some kind of outsourcing. So we've been able to point to some tangible savings, which I'm happy to say. So I'll pause there before I move on to sort of part two of the report, but that's kind of where that first 6-month plan is at. Thanks.
Are there any questions for Mr. Sunbury before? Seeing none, I think the goal of the 6-month work plan was just to give us more agility. This seems to be a very changing time with the system and budgets and cutbacks and CARES Act money, and just being able to adjust at a 6-month basis rather than tying up all our hours at the beginning of every year, I think is kind of the goal of moving to that 6 months.
Thank you, Chair Carter. Yes, you're absolutely right. And so speaking of 6-month updates, I think that's a perfect segue into sort of the next part of the report. And I'll direct the committee to page 7, which is where you'll see some charts and graphs tracking some of our open findings at the institutions. And again, I love to remind the committee whenever I can that this report, our exception report, was pushing nearly 200 pages in the past. So, you know, again, with some minimal formatting efforts and based on feedback and removal of duplicative items, we were able to make this a much more digestible report. which is always a good thing. So on page 7, this graph tracks the unresolved findings, and it now shows a 5-year trend. So you'll see that roughly 5 years ago, these unresolved items were typically in the 30s. And in more recent periods, that number has been shaved down even to the even into the single digits at the institution. So in this period, we did have a bit of an uptick. I think there's 17 unresolved findings now. But if you look at the corresponding aging on the following page, you'll see that all of these relate entirely to the current period. So understandably, we've had a few findings that were noted where, you know, fully satisfying these recommendations may have to wait until a post-COVID environment. So I think if you're looking at the overall trend, understanding there's going to be peaks and valleys, it's a downward trajectory, and that's really the combined effort of, you know, this committee and its willingness to monitor and keep people honest, as well as the hard work from the institutions to make sure that they're buying in to this. I think I may have mentioned before that one of the top metrics that we like to look for in internal audit is, you know, what are our number of open issues or number of past due issues? And beyond just the general accountability, it's usually a strong indicator of management buying in to what an internal audit is recommending. Thanks. I'll stop there and see if there's any questions. Thank you.
Do we have any questions, Mr. Sundberg? Seeing none, did you have anything else, Mr. Sundberg?
Nope, that's all.
But just, I guess, in relation to these hours as well, we're anticipating possibly some additional work for our external auditor because of requirements. I don't know if this would be appropriate time to kind of talk about that.
Yes, happy to talk about that, Joe Sundberg, for the record. So I included some additional hours for external audit assistance in anticipation of some potential help with the external auditors doing some testing around the CARES Act. So in conversations I've had with our partner at Grant Thornton, they fully anticipate, and the OMB has indicated that CARES Act dollars will be auditable. However, there wasn't anything mentioned in the recently released compliance supplement for the auditors to do. So the latest I know on that is that there will be some kind of addendum released in the fall, which is kind of vague, but we anticipate sometime in the fall that the external auditors will need to come back, do some testing around CARES Act dollars received. So I have indicated to Grant Thornton, if it can help keep some of those costs down, we are absolutely willing to have our audit manager help out with that testing. So again, another potential cost savings opportunity. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Sunbury? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to accept the work plan and status report.
Second.
Who is the motioner? Heard the
I'll
second
make the
from McMichael.
I'll make the motion.
Okay. Regent Hayes for the motion, McMichael for the second. All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Yes.
All opposed? Motion carries. We'll move on to item number 6, internal audit compliance and Title IX update. Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury, Chief Internal Auditor. We introduced this information-only section as kind of a standing item. Gives us the ability to provide departmental updates, and more importantly, just have some discussions, right, that are important and relevant. So in the past, I've used this platform to speak with the committee on financial aid-related findings, walk through our risk assessment update into our methodology, speak about internal audit work that was being done for other board committees, things of that nature. So today just really have mostly some administrative updates, but in terms of compliance, this committee will recall, I updated the committee at the last meeting with some general background on the compliance hotline, how it came into existence, and some metrics around it. And we'll continue to formally update the committee on that activity versus national benchmarking category percentages as those get released. There was a question, I believe, from Regent Hayes regarding volume of calls and how that may compare. And I was able to find some national data. I'm still looking to exhaust some of my sources for some higher ed specific comparisons, which I hope to bring forward for our next update. But in terms of national comparisons and for volume, just to kind of give an idea of what we're dealing with, nationally, and this is through all types of enterprises, right? Not just higher education, just all sorts of industries. But volume averages out at 1.4 cases per 100 employees. So back of the napkin math, that would mean that, you know, if we were hitting the national average in terms of volume, we probably have seen, you know, maybe around 160 cases by now. And we've seen roughly 80. So our volume is trending below that. And so there's a number of reasons why that could be. And that's why I'd like to get some additional information as it relates specifically to higher ed. I'll remind this committee that this hotline is meant to sort of supplement a lot of the excellent resources that the institutions already have. So I would expect us to be below the national average. When you compare that to perhaps other companies, publicly traded companies who have, you know, one standalone whistleblower hotline, right? So I just wanted to share that just because that was an ask of Regent Hayes at the last meeting. And again, we'll look to get additional information, higher ed specific, at the next meeting. And then the other compliance related item I wanted to touch briefly on is that the former director of compliance here had compiled a very useful compliance inventory. And I mentioned this because I think it goes along nicely with my earlier internal audit update. It's important that a portion of that audit plan can and should be dedicated to not just updating this inventory for the sake of updating it, but using it as an important tool that allows us to work with the second line of defense at the institution, some of their compliance folks, perhaps help them identify gaps, team up with them to do some testing in some of those compliance-related areas. I think this is a good example of where internal audit needs to do whatever it can, wherever it's most useful, even if it blurs those lines of defense a little bit. I've had discussions with several compliance folks in recent weeks around the system and already getting some good ideas of where we might be able to utilize some of this time. So I think if you looked at the audit plan that you recently approved, there's a compliance coordination bucket of time in there, and that's where we plan on using that. So I'll pause there before I head on to any administrative Title IX updates. Thanks.
Any questions about that for Mr. Sunbury?
Regent Carter, this is Lisa Levine. Can I ask a question even though I'm not on the subcommittee?
Yes, sure.
Thank you. Mr. Sunbury, can you say those numbers again? You mentioned that the whistleblower hotline isn't utilized as much as the national statistics are. Can you just say those numbers again for me?
Sure. So the volume nationally, according to Navex Global, which is the company we use, is 1.4 cases per 100 employees.
How many do we have?
As of earlier this week, I believe we were at 78 cases.
What's the calendar year for how you do it? Just January through December?
Yes. So, yes, when I reported in June, let me see if I can pull that. Yeah, we just used calendar year to update some of those, just compared to some of those benchmarks, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Just to add a little color to that or color commentary, so the institutions themselves would also have a hotline potentially as well, and so the call percentage that we get would not necessarily be the cumulative amount of calls. It would just be the calls that come to the system level versus coming to the institution level. Like, the kind of important to differentiate. Mr. Sunbury, does that sound right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think just to reiterate sort of what I mentioned at the last meeting when trying to baseline a few of these metrics, I think we look very much at, as this hotline became established, I think one of its most important uses is to serve as a way to direct employees or students to the appropriate resource, right? And so I think the other thing that happens is you know, there's it's a way to provide an early warning sign if there's some problem areas brewing in a given area or organization. And I think to that end, you know, this hotline has kind of served that purposes. We're able to, I guess, navigate these cases to the appropriate resource on campus so that the proper subject matter expert can assist.
Okay, Regent Carter, I have a follow-up then. Mr. Sunbury, so procedurally, what would happen then? Because I have received some communication that was anonymous since joining the board about the whistleblower procedure. And so let's say that a student or a faculty member, whomever it might be, they go and they put something into the system. You said it's a hotline, so I'm assuming it's over the phone. It's not over the internet. Is that right? It's not on a website?
Regent Levine, there are two options. There is a 1-800 number, and I always try to get that plug in publicly at these meetings. So the 1-800 number is 844-762-5214, and a student or an employee will always receive a live person to speak with no matter when they call. And then there is also actually a link below the pictures of the regents, I guess, on the front page of the nc.nevada.edu. There's a link, I believe, that says, you know, if you'd like to report a concern, you know, click here, that type of thing. So there is a web option as well.
And then it can be anonymous, or do you have to give your identity up?
It absolutely can be anonymous. And the nice thing about this platform is if someone does submit something anonymously, they're given I forget the technical term for it, but it's some kind of key that only they would know, so they can log back in and kind of see the case status. If they report anonymously, we're able to utilize the platform to actually, we may not know who it is, but we can communicate with that person. They can log back in and see, oh, we've asked a follow-up question because maybe there wasn't quite enough information to pursue, or we didn't know exactly where to send this one. So we've actually done that before where we've followed up with someone and they've responded so we could actually get it to the right spot.
And then so last follow-up for me, just to close that loop, when you say the follow-up, then whom would that go to? That would then go to one of the institutions that whistleblower incident occurred on or at or with?
So in most scenarios, I'd say roughly probably about two-thirds of the scenarios, we will refer the case to a proper subject matter expert, whether it's HR related, whether it's in the employee relations office, whether it's the finance office. And so that typically, I'd say more often than not, is how we'd like the institution and the proper subject matter expert to handle that. And then what I do is essentially I'm able to track these in our software and monitor them, and I'm able to follow up periodically to see where the status is at, which I also think helps to close the loop on many of these.
Do you think that confuses people then who want to utilize the whistleblower complaint, that there are all these different places that they could go?
It's possible. I think, you know, I try to be clear with, you know, whenever I update the committee on this item that, you know, even in its inception, I think we wanted to not necessarily take away from the excellent resources that the institutions have, but we just, if a student didn't know where to go, we are an option, right? And so maybe a student doesn't realize that, there's, you know, I can go to this particular office on campus. If they come to us and we're able to help direct them, I'd like to think that it's hopefully more helpful than confusing, but you're right. I mean, there are many avenues a student can take.
Thank you for answering my questions.
My pleasure.
just once again to add a little commentary to that. So once the stuff goes to Sunbury, the chair of the board and me as the audit committee chair also follow up on that. So everything is tracked and we follow up. So my preference usually is, unless it's a big whistleblower complaint, is them to go to the institution. And if they think the institution is not doing something, then they can report it to us, or they could just report it straight to us. It doesn't matter either way. But any constituents that you have that are having issues, get that message out. That's what it's there for. Mr. Sunbury is in that position, and we would love to see that utilized, and it gives us a way to track what's going on and see if there's places that need to be audited or looked at for further investigation. Mr. Sunbury, you had a second part to update us on?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Carter. Administratively, in terms of Title IX updates, so this agenda item was prepared and submitted to the board office earlier in August. So the language for this update is pretty generic. And as this committee knows, there's been a number of conversations at the board level on this particular topic, right? So with the federal law being in place now since August 14th, you may have seen on the audit plan, internal audit's committed to timely review of monitoring the institutions as it relates to some of the new policy requirements, including the information that needs to be readily available to the public, right? So I think as we design our audit program, we really want students and employees in mind. If a student needs to find a certain resource, we're designing these audit programs with the idea that, hey, is this readily available? If I'm a student or employee who wants to see, training materials, or wants to, needs to see a number posted or whatever it may be, that's the type of thing that we want to make sure first and foremost is included out there. In fact, we've had situations where a student has reached out directly looking for newly posted policies or training material, and my office was able to thankfully quickly work with the applicable Title IX director, lead the student to the right spot in a very timely fashion. So our role in audit, we're not often student facing, but I think whenever we can help direct a student or an employee to the right resource, we certainly want to help and want to continue to work with the appropriate campus resources to do so. The last item is more of a reminder to the committee. So because these policies were enacted under emergency measures to meet that federal deadline, and I know we have a lawyer in the room, so please correct me if I'm wrong, Z, but we need to bring back the code revisions through the committee and or board within 120 days for formal approval. And so as I did the math, and it just so happens that our December board meeting, which I think is the third and the fourth, that'll actually be at about the 119-day mark. So that seems like perhaps this next meeting should be the appropriate timing for that. Obviously, that's for the committee chair to decide, and maybe that's my segue to turn it back over to Chair Carter for any other comments. Thank you.
That's what we would anticipate, being ready to approve that in December and make any changes necessary to the code. I know that Glenn Bogle has also got a working group of people that are working on some maybe communications about the policy and procedures and how that's going to work on the campus level. So hopefully by the end of the fall or sometime this fall, we'll have some more information sessions on a campus by campus or system level to educate our students and staff about that. Any questions or comments? Or Bo, did you want to add anything to that? No? Okay. Any questions or comments for Mr. Sunbury? Seeing none, was there anything else that you wanted to have in this item, Mr. Sunbury?
I think Vice Chair Del Carlo had a question. Chair Carter?
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Chair Carter. Thank you. When I was on the committee on the hotline, I thought I had asked for a report at some point to see if there's any trends on the hotline calls. And maybe we could get that after a year of reporting. Does anybody recall that? I think I even read it in the minutes. Thank you.
If I may, Chair Carter. Thank you, Vice Chair Del Carlo. Yes, so at the June meeting, my at least initial attempt to provide some information around that was some of our that was some of the benchmarking materials. You know, where what buckets does it fall into? Audit, accounting, financial reporting, business integrity, HR, health and safety, misuse, misappropriation, that kind of thing. So those numbers, at least at that time, and I think the numbers presented at the June meeting were actually as of March 31st. So it probably would be good to do another update on that, perhaps at the next meeting, again, with the nice fancy graphs. And then I guess in terms of additional trends, we do track internally particular locations. So, you know, is the case, are cases coming in at a certain campus? And then we could actually probably take that a step further too and look at departmentally, right? If cases are coming in, are they, you know, do they relate to a certain school, a certain function? And so that is something we could splice, but hopefully I can build off of maybe what was presented in June and perhaps bring that forward to December if that works.
Thank you. That'd probably be up to Chair Carter of the committee, but I just think it's, you know, I'm not trying to create a ton of work for anybody, but I really think it's important. I'm really glad we have this hotline. I think it's important. It's a great way for people that don't want to come forward any other way to alert us to problems. And I think the data, if we compile the data, we should be able to read the data, interpret the data, and to just like a self-check, are things okay, things not okay, identify a problem, tackle the problem. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
No, and thank you for those comments, Vice Chair Del Carlo. I think the other thing that maybe I failed to mention too when I submitted the audit plan for discussion and approval from this group is we do our best to utilize data from that we've compiled from the hotline to you know, to include for areas of, hey, we should probably do a deeper dive into this particular area on this particular at this particular institution. So that does get embedded, and it's certainly one of the factors we consider as we compile our 6-month plan.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Seeing none, we'll go on to item number 7, new business. Is there any new business? Seeing none, we'll move on to item number 8, public comment. Do we have any public comment?
There is no public comment.
Then the meeting of the Audit and Title IX Committee is adjourned.